We are dancers. We dance to celebrate, we dance to mourn, we dance to seduce, we boogie.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk, dance as a way of knowing.
Nietzsche says, it is our habit to think outdoors, walking, leaping, climbing, dancing.
What do you see when you look at a dance?
Is dance a kind of perception?
Dancing is not just moving the body. Dancing is thoughtful. Dancing is attentive. It is this arena for paying attention, looking, listening, doing, and undergoing.
Do dancers know something that the rest of us don't?
Why in the world has philosophy neglected dance?
Our guest is UC Berkeley philosopher Alvin Owen.
My view is that we make use of knowledge, practical, intellectual, bodily, all together, when we dance.
Dance as a way of knowing.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. I want to boogie with you.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Mars Theater in Berkeley, the Bay Area's breeding ground for new performance.
Our thinking originates on the other side of the Bay, at Stanford University. There at Philosopher's Corner, Ken and I are professors.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Our topic today, dance. Dance as a way of knowing.
Okay, Ken, I'll bite. How can dance be a way of knowing? Most things we know through perception or through thinking and reasoning about what we perceive. Dance isn't a form of perception, and it's not a form of thinking or reasoning either.
Well, John, I think you're just in the grips of a somewhat outmoded philosophical picture. You're thinking of knowledge as something like justified true belief. That went out a long time ago, John.
Maybe so, but it happens to be true. You can't know something unless you believe it. If you know something, you not only have to believe it, it has to be true. True belief isn't enough for genuine knowledge because it could just be a lucky guess. You have to have evidence, something that justifies your belief. So whatever else it is, knowledge is justified true belief. Dance is not in the business of producing true beliefs or false beliefs. It doesn't provide a justification for anything, except in the case of my dancing, it provides a justification for sitting down and not trying anymore. Dance is dance. Knowledge is knowledge. Why are you mixing them and me up?
But John, you know, slow down a little bit. We haven't even said what dance is just yet. So don't you think we should do that before you diss the idea that dance could be a way of knowing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think we already know what dance is, but maybe you can produce some deep and insightful definition that will suddenly change everything. So why don't you give it a shot?
Well, dance is something that involves movement of the body. We could say it's essentially an embodied activity.
Well, la-di-da. I mean, that doesn't narrow it down very much. I mean, walking my dog is an essentially embodied activity. Picking my nose is an essentially embodied activity. Everything, things I do all day long are essentially embodied, but we don't call them all dance.
Okay, I wasn't finished, okay? Dance can be lots of different things. It can be rhythmic. It can be performed to music or to a beat. It can be an expression of an emotion or an aesthetic impulse. It can be a social activity performed with a partner. It could even be part of a ritual or a spiritual practice. There's so many different styles, so many different forms and functions that dance can have, and other than being an essentially embodied activity, I don't think there's a single trait that all forms of dance have in common like maybe you're looking for.
Well, what you're telling me is that dance is a concept of the sort that Wittgenstein called a family resemblance concept. His example was games. There's not one essential feature that defines all kinds of games, and I guess you're saying the same is true for all kinds of dances. There's not an essential feature. There's instead a series of overlapping similarities that group these different practices together into one extended family.
I see, now you're getting it. That's a really nice way of putting it, John.
Yeah, but it's just a kind of a fancy way, citing Wittgenstein, for saying there really isn't any one thing that all these dances have in common, or all dancing has in common, aside from being a bodily activity. Look, let's just give up on defining it. Just try to explain to me why dance is knowledge.
Well, the important thing is the embodied nature of dance. That's the key, I think. Dance isn't just movement. It's movement that relates you to the world. When you dance, the world becomes present to you through the dance.
When I dance, the world usually becomes present to me by my tripping over it, which I don't know. I guess that's a form of knowledge. But if it's the embodied nature of dance that's important, then couldn't we just as easily say that walking is a way of knowing?
Well, John, you got it. That's a great inference. I mean, think about knowing a space. A great way to know a space is not just to observe it passively from a fixed position, but, you know, to wonder about in it. When you walk through the space opens up to you. You perceive things that you wouldn't have perceived if you hadn't moved around. Dance is like that. As a form of active bodily engagement with the world, it opens up the world to you in a new way that nothing else can do.
Well, I grant you, we perceive while we dance or walk, but that doesn't make dancing or walking in and of itself a form of perception.
I think you're thinking of perception in the wrong way. I think you're thinking of perception as passive. The world just washes over your senses with energy and something happens in your brain. I grant you, dance isn't like that. But you know what? Perception, genuine perception, isn't like that either. Perception requires active bodily engagement with the world. Dance does too. That's why dance counts as a kind of perception.
Sounds like you buy into that trendy extended or embodied mind view that rejects the perfectly sensible idea that the mind is a function of the brain or central nervous system. Okay. But even if we accept the view that movement is a form of perception, or at least that perception always involves movement, I'm still don't quite get how dance is a way of knowing.
Well, we'll try it another way. Science like to use models to help them understand, you know, really complex phenomena they're trying to study. Well, so think of dance as a model of our active embodied engagement with the world, and since all perception is that, dance is a model of perception.
Well, Ken, us outmoded fossils have to get used to the idea that younger people like yourselves have really good ideas that we can't quite grasp. Having said that, I don't know what you're saying, but I'm sure not convinced of it.
Well, John, you might be surprised to discover what dance can actually do for not just our bodily capacities, but our cognitive capacities. So we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch, to find out how dancing affects our brains. She files this report.
Every week at a senior center in Alameda, California, about a dozen women get together to dance the hula.
Do the hula, if there's anything you'd like to say.
I'm 85 and 4 months, last September, so 85 and 4 months.
Amy Harris has been coming to the hula class for 13 years. She says as she gets older, it's hard to stay in shape.
So I keep on moving so that I can retain my flat stomach, my tummy.
But she also comes for the company. Amy says after her husband's death, she would spend long days alone, and she noticed her memory was starting to get a little dull.
I forget things. I go to the bedroom to get something. When I reach there, what am I here for? But then when I started, you know, having some company, talking to people, meeting friends, and, you know, then I said, oh, I noticed I am not that forgetful anymore.
There might actually be something to Amy's claims that the hula class keeps her memory sharp. Dr. Joe Verghese is a neurology professor at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York. He studies the effects of aging and disease on cognition, and he was one of the first people to show that dancing is associated with a reduced risk of dementia.
Because it also involves mental efforts. You have to remember steps, you have to adapt to your partner. So it is a mentally challenging activity as well.
About 10 years ago, Verghese was poring through data collected in the 1980s as part of the Bronx Aging Project, where researchers interviewed elderly folks about their habits.
Reading, writing, playing a musical instrument, taking part in group discussions, and the physical activities included things like walking for exercise, climbing stairs, and also included dancing as one of the 11 activities that they studied.
Verghese decided to look at how these activities affect cognition. Overall, physical exercises had little effect, except dancing.
Here's the figures. So in the Bronx Aging Study, people who dance frequently, which was two or three times a week or more, had a 76% reduced risk of developing dementia over the next few years compared to people who either never danced or danced rarely.
76%. That's more than crossword puzzles or reading. But why? Verghese says it might have to do with how certain kinds of exercise affect the brain.
These activities promote brain growth factors in the brain. They might be responsible for creating new cells and new connections in the brain.
People who exercise, both mentally and physically, might have better, stronger brains.
More synaptic connections in their brain or better networks in the brain so that when they actually get the dementia process, they are able to ward off the effects for a longer period of time. So it's not that it prevents the disease, but it helps mask the disease for a longer period of time.
Another thing that helps reduce the risk of dementia is socializing. That's one of the reasons 77-year-old Charney Smith comes to hula class.
It's a wonderful social experience because you become friends with a lot of what we call our hula sisters. And it's just very rewarding to me.
Charney says before she started hula 5 years ago, she did not consider herself a dancer.
No, I've never done any dancing before except, social dancing. Never taken a dancing class before. But hula is so beautiful, and it makes you feel so good when you do it. You really do feel good when you're dancing.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
I'm John Perry. I'm here along with my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor. And we're coming to you from the Marsh Theater in Berkeley, California.
And our guest today is a professor of philosophy at UC Berkeley. He's also a philosopher in residence at the Foresight Dance Company in Frankfurt, Germany. He's author most recently of Varieties of Presence. Please welcome Alva Noe.
Alva, like Ken and me, you're a philosopher trained in the Western analytic tradition. Your research is on consciousness, perception, action, all respectable topics. You also work with dancers. You're even a philosopher in residence at a contemporary dance company. How did this happen to a nice young analytical philosopher?
It's a good question, and it's one I'm still trying to work out. In fact, I've sort of just been using this occasion to forage and find philosophy to do there. It all started, I think, when I was a kid growing up in New York. My dad's girlfriend was a dancer, and she used to take me to these performances I couldn't understand. And I remember sitting there being convinced that there was something I was supposed to be getting that I couldn't get. And then fast forward quite a few years, my first book, Action and Perception, was all about perception and its relation to action. And although I wrote it for a philosophical audience, philosophy and cognitive science, to my surprise, it was sort of taken up in the dance community. And the dancers started reaching out to me and starting conversations with me and inviting me into their workshops. And it was things have just sort of taken on from there. And I'm still looking to see what I'm going to learn from it and what I can contribute to what they're doing.
So earlier, Ken and I were discussing the thesis that dance is a form of knowledge, and Ken couldn't get very far in convincing me of that. But let's set that kind of extreme thesis aside and just say, well, clearly from your work, you think that dance has a special relevance to philosophy. It's an extremely important thing for us to understand that will help us understand knowledge. Yeah. So tell us about it.
Yeah, I mean, for me, actually, in a way, the prior question is, why in the world has philosophy neglected dancing? And I think there's a good explanation for it, and it has to do with the fact that our legacy as philosophers and our legacy as cognitive science is really a kind of a close cousin to philosophy, is what I call intellectualist. It's internalist. It's individualist. The idea is that mind is in our heads, And the business of the mind is figuring out what's in the world around us and building up mental representations. And the thing is, from the standpoint of that intellectualist legacy, the body itself is external, and the movement of the body is external. And the body becomes nothing more than a vehicle or a vessel for carrying this mind inside us around.
It's that tradition which leads philosophers to think knowledge, that's belief, beliefs inside your head, maybe beliefs that have a certain kind of relation, they're justified or something like that. But that's what John was saying, justified true belief. He's right in that intellectualist tradition, aren't you, John?
Yes, yes. Well, I don't know if I am, but my brain definitely is.
The thing is, from this point of view, it's hard to even find a way to bring dancing on the agenda. And the thing is, dancing as a phenomenon just doesn't fit with the intellectualist picture.
Well, let me give an example that is not intended as a challenge, but to help you disclose. It's very short. So consider a quadriplegic, somebody who has no control over anything except their eyes, really. Maybe if they have an eye tracker hooked up, they can affect a lot of things with their eyes. But now, such a person is capable of knowing. It doesn't seem like dance is much a part of it. Or would you say that the activity of the eyes is itself a form of dance?
Oh, well, you're anticipating something, which in fact I think, that perceiving is a form of dancing. But first be clear about why dance is so important. Dancing is not just moving the body. Dancing is thoughtful. Dancing is attentive. Dancing is a kind of thinking as much as it is fully embodied. Note also this, that dancing is not something that is directed by your conscious mind. You get absorbed in the dance. You get caught up and carried away with it. And what I want to say is that perceiving is just like that for the paraplegic as much as for you or I.
But at least in the paraplegic case, the dancing is inside the head, if the eyes are inside the head.
But you know what? We're going to let you go. We're going to hash this out. Yes. After a break.
We'll dance.
This is a philosophy talk coming to you from the Mars Theater in Berkeley. We're talking about dance as a way of knowing with Alva Noe, author of Varieties of Presence.
Are you a dancer? Are there particular insights you gain from your dancing? Does dance improve your cognitive capacities?
Cognition, perception, and dance, along with questions from our audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Thanks to our musical guests, the Playtones. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Alva Noe from the UC Berkeley, and we're talking about dance as a way of knowing.
Is dance just a physical activity, a cognitive activity, both? Join the discussion by stepping up to the microphone and adding your voice to the mix.
So look, Alva, philosophers traditionally distinguish between perception and thought as two related but different sources of knowledge. Now, how are you thinking about dance? You're thinking about dance as an offshoot of that? Is it a third source of knowledge? Is it equivalent to perception? How are you thinking about that?
You know, something that we haven't tried to distinguish at all, but maybe it's worth doing, is that there's a difference between dancing, that stuff you do in the discotheque or that you do at your cousin's wedding, and what you watch when you go to see, you know, a Balanchine performance, or for example, something here in Counterpulse in San Francisco, something offbeat and experimental and edgy. Dancing as art, dancing as choreography is really a kind of, I think, a very different project, one which does aim at knowledge. It's most of the dancers I know who work as choreographers or performing artists think of it as a form of research itself. In fact, I've come to think that choreography stands to dancing in something like the relation of philosophy of perception to perception.
Wait, okay, so the kind of dance you're talking about is choreographed artistic dance. Okay, so we want to focus on that. So we're talking about dancing as knowledge, as a kind of cognition or perception or something different from cognition and perception that has to be added to the kit of things that are sources of knowledge. That's what I want to know. I claim that dancing was a kind of perception. Right, in the opening. I wonder if you endorse that view or if you think dancing as knowledge is something different from either perception or thought, some third thing.
The idea that I'm trying to explore is that perception is a kind of dancing, and that therefore, by studying dancing and by looking at the work of dancers, we could learn something about perceptual consciousness itself.
What does that mean? The perception is a kind of dancing.
Well, consider this. Let me just direct your attention to some basic features of dancing now. Now I mean the kind of stuff we do at the bar mitzvah. Dancing is basic. It is spontaneous. It is automatic. It seems kind of natural and primitive. And yet, at the same time, it is this arena for paying attention, looking, listening, doing and undergoing, responding. It is thoughtful. It is also not something which any of the people doing the dancing so is sort of choreographing. The point about it is that dancing is a sort of a basic mode of organized activity, and that's exactly what perception
okay,
is
wait,
like,
wait,
too.
Okay, wait. Lots of things are organized modes of activity. I'm going to be like skeptical like John now, because you seem to be saying something different from what even I think, and I was kind of far out there, right? Lots of things are organized forms of activity. Baseball playing is an organized form of bodily activity. So does that make a perception a kind of baseball playing? A war is an organized form of bodily activity. Would that follow that dancing is, perception is a kind of war? So I don't understand what you mean dancing is. I understand what you might mean when you say dancing is a mode of perception, but you're saying perception is a mode of dancing. It's going the other way. I don't see why you would say that.
When you approach an object, it looms in your visual field. When you blink, you modify your sensory relationship to it. When you walk around it, its profile changes. Everything we do, every movement of our body, our movements of our eyes, produces sensory events. So whatever else we're doing when we're perceiving, we are making use of this very sophisticated embodied sensory motor knowledge. And how do we understand where the perceiving is going on? What I would suggest is that it's not something that is going on inside the perceiver, just as the dance is not going on inside the perceiver. But nor is it something that the perceiver is sort of thinking about or planning or controlling. We need another level at which to analyze it. It's the level of embodiment.
I'm going to ask John if he's happy with this. You were puzzled by what I was saying. I wonder, does Alva clear it up for you?
Well, not exactly, but it suggests a lot of things to me. It seems to me if you think about the difference between, inanimate matter like rocks and then very primitive organisms like amoeba and so forth and so on, and you try to say where knowledge is or where it begins, there'd be a lot of motivation for saying knowledge begins with activity. It begins with not just being a passive effect of other causes, but with, self-initiated movements that somehow then respond to the environment around it. That's not representation, which must come in the service of that at some later point, is really the beginnings of knowledge. That all makes sense to me. It makes sense to me that movement and knowledge are really intimately related. Why dance, though? Is it all activity that's devoted to knowledge? Is this rhythmic
this
or
is very
constrained
helpful.
Or what?
This is very helpful. You're pointing out that action seems to be causally crucial for our perceptual lives. But actually what I'm arguing is that it is constitutive of our perceptual lives. That what perceiving is a temporally extended, dynamic interaction, a transaction with the world around us. Now, can you think of a better definition of what dancing is?
Well, no, but I can't think of any remotely adequate definition of what dancing is.
But again, now it really sounds to me like bodily engagement is the crucial thing. And dancing is certainly a deep and important and beautiful form of bodily engagement. And it sounds partly like what makes you want to assimilate active bodily engagement to perception is the skillfulness kind of. So philosophers make a distinction between knowledge of facts, and know-how. And know-how is, lots of people think, a kind of essentially embodied thing that can't be reduced to knowledge of facts, which is potentially just locked up in your brain somehow. But know-how is essentially embodied. It's skill-oriented. And it sounds like you want to say that perception is kind of a skillful bodily engagement. Right, and dancing is the skillful bodily engagement, but so is walking, so is playing baseball, so is playing chess, so is war. So I'm still, I love dancing, but I'm trying to figure out why that particular metaphor, I don't know if you even think of it as a metaphor, that particular thing, that particular kind of bodily engagement is what you think is worth philosophers focusing on much harder than they have.
So I think that there are five features of dancing that make it very important for this case. One is that it's basic and primitive. The other is that despite that, it's thoughtful and involves the exercise of perception and attention. Another is that it happens spontaneously. When you're dancing, you're letting go. You're not planning your next move. Another is that it serves functions. It brings people together. It serves all sorts of ritual functions and attachment functions. Another feature is that it's a domain of potential pleasure. Now, what I want to suggest is anything which is like that is that's a feature that many let me try to put that differently. That those features characterize perception as well as dancing. They do not characterize war. They do not characterize
okay,
baseball.
That's okay. But the one thing you said that puzzles me, the first thing you said, dancing is primitive. Dancing is primitive. But then you talked about not the stuff you do at the bar mitzvah, but the stuff you see at dance recitals, choreographed. That's not primitive.
Yeah.
That's
also not dancing. That's dance. That's choreography. And that's something like, I would say, the investigation of dance, or the display of dance, or the representation of dance, mm-hmm. or the reflection on dance. I mean, and now we get into the philosophy of art. And why is putting something that we normally do in the disco or with our friends, putting it on stage, and putting it on stage in the very special way that artists
there's
do?
There's a lot of different things going on here. Maybe our very engaged, bodily engaged audience can help us. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're in front of a live audience at the March Theater in Berkeley, talking about dance as a way of knowing. And we've got some questions from that live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, this is Nate from San Francisco. My question is this. Is dance, the spontaneous or creative type, the experience of intuitive knowledge?
Intuitive, don't go away. What do you mean by intuitive knowledge? What do you have in mind? I have something in mind, but I want to know if we're on the same page.
Well, intuitive means less of sort of thinking knowledge and more of immediate response, instinctive.
Yeah, that sounds like something you'd like.
Yeah, and well, dancing is involves the exercise of practical skill. And in that sense, it doesn't require, although it doesn't entirely exclude, our ability to think about what we're doing. It's like when I reach for this bottle, I adjust my hand to grasp it perfectly. And in a similar way, when I dance, I get entrained, I get wrapped up in the music and in the interaction with the other and with the world around me.
Let me ask you a question. I mean, the concept of play is something that we do with respect to animals like dogs. Dogs play with each other. They, you know, they pretend to bite, but they don't bite and so forth. Children play with each other. They run around. It's very active, and I'm sure it produces all kinds of knowledge. Is there something that dance, a constraint that it has to fulfill to be dance as opposed to merely active play?
I think it has something to do with its temporal and spatial organization. Now, to be precise about that requires that we look closely. And by the way, lots of things are temporally and spatially organized. Conversation is temporally and spatially organized. When two people talk, they're not just exchanging thoughts. Their postures, their volume, mm-hmm. their eye movements all get in sync with each other. I would say that dancing is a kind of conversation, or rather that dancing and conversation and perception both exhibit these features of organization, which make them so cognitively and biologically
but
interesting.
Here's a little puzzlement I have. I mean, I can understand actually how I can perceive the cup by grasping, right? I mean, that makes sense to me in a certain extended sense of perception, which might be the primary sense. Mm-hmm. I grasp the cup. I see the cup. Mm-hmm. I think about the cup. Mm-hmm. So my thought has what philosophers call intentionality. My mm-hmm. perception has something like intentionality, has an mm-hmm. object directedness. Mm-hmm. My reaching and grasping has the kind of object mm-hmm. directedness, but I don't dance the cup, right? It doesn't, that, I mean, there could be an extended metaphor in which I try to make that cup vivid to you through a dance that illustrates, you know, it's sitting there. You know, something like that.
Go ahead. Don't be inhibited.
It doesn't make immediate intuitive sense to say, I dance the cup. I mean, I can dance the room, but that means I dance through the room, not I dance the room as the object of my dance, the way that I see the room.
You don't dance the cup. The cup dances you. The cup choreographs you. The cup solicits from you a way of moving in relation to it. You know, one of the legacies of this intellectualist tradition is that our paradigm case is, here's the object and I now contemplate it. But most of our perceptual lives are on the run, there's the bus, trying to catch it, avoiding the obstacle, trying not to trip. It's task embedded, it's contextualized. My thought is not on my act of perception, but on the thing that interests me. And all of that, I think, involves exactly the kind of highly thoughtful and yet automatic. That's the interesting thing. We're in the space of habit and automatism that you see in the world of dance.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ben. What's your comment or question?
Hi, my name is Ariella Popple, and I'm from Albany, California. In the past couple of weeks, I've been studying a choreography called Break the Chain that we've been practicing for a dance flash mob to end violence against women and the oppression of women. And in the course of practicing, there were a lot of emotions coming up in everybody. And also, I wanted to say that although the knowledge that we were learning was, in a sense, just the steps of the dance, there were so many more ideas in it besides that, a history of relations between men and women and ideas of political activism. So I was wondering, what is the role of emotions and what exactly is the knowledge that you say is embodied in dance?
I think that's a really fascinating question, but I actually think it shows something different about dance. Dance has an expressive function, right? And in that way, you said language is a coordinated embodied activity. Seems to me, if I were going to assimilate dance to something else, it would be more like something that's communicative. I don't think of perception as communicative. I can communicate what I perceive, but the perceiving itself is not communicated until I make it present to another through language or through enactment or something like that. So why not think of dance as a theater of expressivity rather than, if some philosophers sometimes think, I know you don't, but philosophers sometimes think of perception as what they call receptivity and thinking as spontaneity, right? And dance isn't a form of receptivity, but it's more of a form of spontaneity and therefore expressive, like language is expressive. Why not think of it like that?
I do think that's actually, I'm very sympathetic to what you just said and also to what the commentator said. Dancing is bound up with communication. When I'm dancing with you, we are actually communicating, and everything that shapes the quality and meaning and significance of our communication is there in play. But again, I want to just ask us to think carefully about the difference between dancing in the way in which Tony Manero, the main character in Saturday Night Fever, is getting down in the discotheque, and dancing in the sense in which I'm actually trying to create an event, a spectacle, which, as in the case you describe, may be one of political significance, right? So I think there's different projects there.
So we got another question from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Man.
Hi, I'm Catherine. I'm a San Francisco-based dancer and choreographer. My question has to do with this idea of choreography and dance, sort of with a capital D, and how audiences perceive performances. A common response that I often hear when I go to shows and also when people view my own work is, I didn't understand that, or there was something to get and I didn't get it. Mm-hmm. I'm curious about how we as dancers and philosophers help audiences to understand that there may not be something to get that they're missing, or the experience itself might be what's valuable.
That's a beautiful question. Thank you. I mean, one of the things that to say about that is, when you go to a dance performance, often what happens is there's a real transformation that happens from not getting it at all to beginning in bits and pieces to get resources that enable you to get something, not the definitive thing which there is to get, but there's a real change that happens from sort of not seeing to seeing, or not getting it at all to getting it. And I think that precisely that movement, that transformation, is a very philosophical movement and a very philosophical transformation. And that's one of the connections I see precisely between choreography and philosophy.
This response to dance, there's something there, but I don't get it. That's the usual response when I give a philosophy talk. Yeah. So, or maybe that's a maybe dance is a form of philosophy.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. This time we're talking about dance as a way of knowing with UC Berkeley professor and philosopher in residence at the Foresight Dance Company, Alva Noe.
Is there a way to incorporate movement or dance into philosophical inquiry? Aristotle famously walked with his students around the Lyceum in ancient Athens. He was a peripatetic. Was he onto something? Or maybe just had an itchy bottom. Who knows? Can moving our bodies improve our philosophical thinking?
We're coming to you from the Mars Theater, the Bay Area's breeding ground for new performance. We'll take more questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Do you love me? Do you
Thanks to our musical guests, the Playtones. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Alva Noah, author of Varieties of Present. So, Alva, I want to try something on you, though. I'm going to offer you a friendly amendment kind of thing to see if I can bridge a gap. Okay, so I think, I ask you, well, dance doesn't really have an object the way that seeing has an object, the way that grasping has an object. But then I thought, well, maybe it does, because go back to the opening. I said, here's a way to know a room, and I really do think it's a way to know a room. Wander about in it. Explore the space through walking. I mean, you can explore the space through looking, but exploring the space through walking, I think, is a way of perceiving the space. Okay, what is dance? Well, just you walk through space, you dance through space. What's the object of the dance? In that sense, the content, it's the movement through space. I know that space affords me the possibility of these movements. And it's another way of perceiving my body, because I know that my body affords through dancing, and only through the dancing, not through just thinking about it, I know that my body affords me the possibilities of these movements through space, and there's a kind of infinite possibility that I may explore. I mean, is that a friendly amendment to your...
Sure. I'm very open to the idea that in exactly the way you describe, that dancing can be a way of making contact with the world around one. It certainly is. But again, what I'm trying to show is that in some fundamental sense, that's the paradigm way in which we come to know the world around us. Perceiving itself is precisely that kind of active exploration.
Well, I guess I want a broader category that might include active perception and passive reception. Because the world does just wash on over me with energy. And then my brain whirs about and does something with those energized excitation. But I can also do something else that's not quite spontaneously thinking, but not just the passive washing of energy. It's move through the world in a bodily engaged way. And that seems, I don't want to call the passive stuff non-perception, but I don't want to have to, and I don't want to have to equate all perception with this active bodily engagement.
But you don't see half the stuff that washes over your nervous system, and you only see it if you're actively primed and engaged and ready and interacting.
That's true.
There is definitely common ground here. But what you said actually reminded me of a slightly related idea. Ask yourself this question when you're in the theater watching a dance performance. What do you see when you look at a dance? What are you looking at? Are you looking at mere movements on the stage? I think one of the ideas that fascinates me, and this really resonates with something you just said, is that what you're seeing is an environment. And insofar as you're seeing the dancers moving, what you're seeing is people acting for the purposes of sort of getting along or getting through or navigating or surviving in that represented environment on the stage.
Let's get some more questions from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, I'm Corinne from Oakland, California. And my question, I think, is much along the lines of what Ken's trying to drive at. We've heard a lot of really interesting descriptions of maybe features of dance that might qualify it as a way of knowing, or at least, you know, give it some properties that maybe are shared with other things like baseball or war, or maybe not. But this idea of perhaps giving an example on the other side of things of what is it that we're actually knowing through this activity of dance, and getting not so much caught up in whether it's the same as perception or a type of perception or the other way around, but maybe if you could give some more concise examples of, much like I see the cup, so some might claim that that's a way of knowing that there is a cup, or maybe that reflection would be a way of knowing something like 2 + 2 = 4. What is it that you would say dance is a way of knowing?
Well, I need to be clear here that this dance as a way of knowing thesis is not my thesis. It's the thesis that was sort of advanced in the opening. My view is that we make use of knowledge, practical, intellectual, bodily, all together, when we dance. And that dance may be a way of knowing, and maybe getting to know you by dancing with you. But the specific, temporally organized thing, which is this dance, what I'm really interested in directing our attention to is how richly physical it is, while at the same time being a sphere of skillful activity, an embodied sphere of skillful activity.
But in fairness to us, you do in some ways assimilate it to perception, which is a way of knowing. So I don't think we're completely...
I don't think perception is a way of knowing either. I'm not interested in this intellectualist problem of how do I tell what's going on there. When I leave here, I don't stop and think, how do I know, which way I'm going? I just start moving, and I let the world guide me, and I shuffle my way home.
Let's get some more questions. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, man.
Hi, I'm Seema from Berkeley. I'm still trying to figure out how the distinction between the art dancing and the social dancing, or Tony Manero, who we argued about before, as somehow not falling under the category of the dancing you're thinking about. You know, how you made the distinction early on, and I'm still trying to figure out why that distinction is necessary for your project. Mm-hmm. And also, I'm wondering if it is, as someone who's engaged in the kind of contemporary dance practice that you seem to privilege or are interested in, that maybe the problem here is that dancing is always held up as somehow not other forms of language, like not talking. Like, it's a form of communication, but it's not the same as talking. But there is no dance practice that occurs without talking at the same time, particularly the kind that you're interested in and privilege, and that I privilege as well. You know, there is no dance training without speech. And so how does that, I can barely formulate the question, but how does that, thinking about that, alter or connect with what you have been saying?
So my basic picture is that there's this given, there's this fact that we are dancers, we boogie, we dance in a million different situations. We dance to celebrate, we dance to mourn, we dance to seduce, we dance to express ourselves. That's this fact about us. We are also talkers, and we do that spontaneously, and we do it naturally, and so on. We're also thinkers, and all of these are embodied, practical, engaged domains, but all of these are at the same time cognitive domains, domains for thinking, domains for investigation. Now enter the choreographer. I think of the choreographer or the philosopher as saying, okay, that's my palette now. I'm going to work with those facts about us, that we are ones who dance, we are ones who talk, we are ones who think, and I'm going to investigate it by, for example, putting it on display, and by asking you in the audience to say, what is that anyway? That's not dancing, that doesn't look like dancing, but I bought a dancing theater ticket, how could that be dancing? And so there's research going on there. And if it involves deploying the same stuff that goes on in the discotheque, that's all well and good. Okay. It's never just about that.
Okay, though. So that's about dance as such. And I could believe those things about dance. It's like a dance theorist and all that.
Yeah.
Without this embodied, extended mind kind of theory of mind that seems to be in the background of a lot of your thinking about this. Because, look, I dance. Stuff happens, goes on in my brain. Why do you reject the idea that it's the brain that's the seat of cognition? Of course, it's a brain in a body that's the seat of cognition, and the brain is like the control, or the central nervous system is like the control center of the body. But you seem to, I read something, and there are lots of people who think this way. You're not alone. And it's a rising trend, and it has deep roots in the history of philosophy, so let's grant all that, right? You want to deny this kind of cognition, perception, knowledge is locked up in the brain. Why? I mean, because, of course, anybody's got to deal with the fact that the brain's in a body, and the brain is for making the body, you know, able to thrive in the world, and the body is for making the brain safe and blah, 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 and, you know, and there's a brain-body interface and a body-world interface. Anybody's got to do that, but you have a very strong view about consciousness, experience, all that stuff not being located in the... You think that's a kind of Cartesian way of thinking about it?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think trying to find thought or consciousness or perception in the brain is a little bit like looking for the value of money on the paper it's printed on. No matter how good your electron microscope is, you're just not going to find it there. Or, to give another comparison, it's like looking for the dance inside the dancer. The dance requires the brain. The dancing requires the body. The dancing requires a transaction with the environment. All of those things are jointly required for there to be dancing. Neural activity alone is neither necessary nor sufficient. Sorry, it's necessary, but it's not sufficient.
John wants to get in there.
Well, no, I mean, it's neither necessary nor sufficient. And you said, but it's necessary. Yeah. Well, it is necessary. I mean, think of the analogy with money. It really limps. Consciousness, perception, like money, get many of their important properties because of social and environmental effects and causes they have. But money doesn't have much interaction with other money on its own, not through human intervention. But our neurons in our brain, we know they are tremendously active. They dance, the dance of the neurons. And so, yes, they are a necessary condition, and not just, I mean, you know, money's a necessary condition. It's got to have some substance to it, I guess, or at least until recently. But the brain is itself an extremely active, complicated, causally interacting thing that is a necessary condition of consciousness, thought, and perception of anything like it occurs in a human form. Yeah. So don't denigrate the brain.
No, I don't denigrate the brain. And I did correct myself. It's necessary, but it's not sufficient. Yeah. And you're not going to find consciousness in the brain, and for exactly the same reason that you're not going to find the dance in the dancer. And part of why this becomes very important is that we really need to think about what's the right level at which, as scientists, to model dancing, say, or perception. And I don't think you're going to do it at the level of neurons whose actions transpire over milliseconds, nor are you going to do it at the level of thoughts and beliefs and actions which transpire over minutes and hours. You need to be more attentive to low-level bodily events and rhythms, an embodiment level, as the roboticist Dana Ballard has called it. And I think this is not the reason why I make the comparison with money. It's not because I actually think that the phenomenon of monetary value is like consciousness, but because I want to show that the mere fact that the value is not in the money doesn't mean it's somehow mysterious or can't be subject to an investigation.
Well, let me give you what I think is a better analogy. Suppose we got a long train, 100 cars with a locomotive at the front, and we notice that the train moves. And we say, I wonder why the train moves. And we say, well, I've got a theory. It's this big engine in the locomotive that makes it move. And you say, well, that may be a necessary condition, but it wouldn't move without the wheels. Well, right, but all the cars have wheels. It's the one that has this big thing in it that has its own internal movements that have been designed to transmit to the external movements of the wheels. That's what you need to understand the whole thing. And I think that's the brain's position in understanding consciousness and thought. It's the nature of the brain, like it's the nature of what's in the engine that explains how the whole thing works.
But remember,
not why the whole thing was built, but how the whole thing works once it gets built.
But remember, that locomotive won't move if it's suspended from a crane.
That's true.
It won't move if it's submerged in water. It's the internal construction of the engine together with the way in which it's situated in the world that needs to be in place for the movement to happen.
None of the undercars will move even if they're not submerged in water and not suspended for a crane. So that's the crucial difference. It's that engine, and it's not just that it's there like a piece of money. It's its internal complexity, and the motion emanates from the engine out, even though the engine was designed with the outside motion.
But you're trying to convince me. You're trying to convince me of the point I've already conceded, that the engine in this case is necessary. Of course,
no.
It's
I'm trying to.
The question is
whether
it's sufficient.
It's a much better model than something passive like money that, because of its social interactions, has a lot of interesting properties.
Let's take one more question from our live audience.
Hi, it's Josh from El Cerrito. We've been talking about dance so far and have hardly talked about the fact that dance is beautiful. It's beautiful to watch, and it's beautiful to do. It's a little bit like talking about the philosophy of sex without mentioning that it feels good. Is there something you can say about the beauty of dance and the beauty of knowing and the relation of those two? Is that important?
Well, see, I think dance as an aesthetic object, as an object of appreciation, that's really a cool thing, and it's a really worthy thing. And I think, Alva, you have a lot to say about that. But that's really different from dance as some kind of form of engagement with the world that delivers some kind of awareness of the world, right? So, I mean, because that's more not the observer of the dance getting the benefit, but the dancer, through the dancing, getting whatever this thing is. But I didn't want to give you a chance to...
No, thanks. Actually, I'm really, you know, beauty is such a very delicate and complicated notion. I'm not quite sure what to say about it. I did, in my very speedy enumeration of some of the features of dancing, I mentioned that dancing is a potential source of pleasure. And, you know, the same is true of conversation. The same is true of breastfeeding. I mean, there's these very complicated things that we do that are arenas in which we think and feel, have pleasure, and sometimes have discomfort.
Our guest has been Alva Noe. He's a professor of philosophy at the UC Berkeley. He's author of Varieties of Presence. Alva, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is, Cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. You can also find out more by visiting our Facebook page, and you can follow our tweets on Twitter, and you can get the free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk at our website, philosophytalk.org.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2013.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Music from Amy Kessler, Carola Kreitmeier, and Joshua Raul Brody, the Playtones.
Special thanks to Eric Blazeski and Stephanie Weissman. Thanks also to Dan Brandon, Caitlin Esch, and Neil Tanner.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Dave Millar is our director of marketing.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.